dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. I have been tremendously impressed by the intelligence of our first guest. Her name is Rachelle Peterson. She is the policy director of a terrific organization, the National Association of Scholars. And she has been leading in several really important projects of the NAS, one involving freedom of speech and the other involving efforts to suppress it, among other things, mounted by the Chinese government through something called the Confucius Institute Empire. We'll be talking briefly with her about both today. First, let me welcome her back. Rachelle, so good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank.
So quickly, in the past weeks, really, you have been hugely successful, it seems to me, in energizing efforts to address the problem of unfree speech, shall we say, in academia. Talk about what the president has done in response and what now is in the works on the Hill.
President Trump has taken a crucial first step in protecting campus free speech by issuing an executive order that conditions federal research grants on colleges and universities protecting freedom of inquiry. This is a really important step, and we should thank President Trump for doing this. However, only about 600 colleges and universities get federal research grants, so we need to back this up with some legislative language that addresses the rest of higher education, and that's what we've been pushing for. Just in the last week or so, we released a statement calling for free speech protections in the Higher Education Act, which has now been signed by more than 500 scholars, writers, and concerned citizens. And we're eager to share that message with Capitol Hill.
And just for calibration's sake, I suspect most people in this audience have had some experience with their own loved ones on college campuses, or perhaps they're themselves. How serious a problem are we confronting in terms of the exercise of our unalienable right to free speech on America's campuses today, Rachelle?
Well, in the last 2 years, there have been nearly 50 attempts to disinvite speakers from college campuses, and more than 120 colleges and universities have speech codes that clearly restrict freedom of speech, often in violation of the First Amendment. And what we're seeing is that public colleges and universities in particular, which are constitutionally required to uphold First Amendment freedoms, are routinely violating them, and Congress has never held them to account. So what we're calling for is that public colleges should be accountable to their First Amendment obligations, and if they don't, they should not be eligible to receive federal student aid.
And the suppression of speakers is of course, just one measure of this. The organizations on campuses are being subjected to pressure as well, sometimes from the administration, sometimes from student activists and enemies of, well, these fundamental rights. It's very worrying, and I think great credit is due to you and your colleagues at the National Association of Scholars that you're standing up for this, and congratulations on pulling together so many like-minded folks who hopefully will help catalyze corrective action by the United States Congress, challenging as that may be, given the makeup of it at the moment. Let me switch gears to the other project that you've been very personally associated with, Rachelle, and that is exposing something called the Hanban in communist China, which is the vehicle that the Chinese Communist Party has been using to penetrate and influence and subvert what's going on our campuses. Talk about how they've been doing that and their success to date.
The Confucius Institutes are a project of the Chinese government aimed at giving students a one-sided picture of China's history, providing colleges and universities with the teachers, the textbook, everything they need to operate a class, kind of taught from China's perspective. And there are more than 1,000 Confucius Institutes and Confucius classrooms around the world. And just in the last couple of years, we're starting to see finally some pushback, which is much needed.
And when you see that pushback, the form that it's taking is, I guess, primarily in closing some of these institutions. What difference does that make on your average college campus, whether there is a Confucius Institute or there isn't, Rochelle?
It makes a big difference. We're now up to 20 colleges and universities in the United States that have closed their Confucius Institutes. This means shuttering an opportunity of propaganda for the Chinese government and protecting college students from getting a misleading and false education about what China is. So this is a hugely important step. The Chinese government does have many other tools that we need to be paying attention to as well, but we should not overlook the fact that this is a big accomplishment.
And my recollection from your earlier study of this was that it's not just what is being propounded in these institutes that is so corrosive to really an accurate understanding of what communist China is like and what it's up to. It's also the influence that those institutions have with the administrations of the campuses and the faculty, for that matter, you know, who can teach about China, what they will teach, the kind of curricula that they use, and so on. Is that the case as well? And where you've seen them shutting down, is there reason to believe that this is being corrected?
Well, you're right, Frank, that one of the key benefits to China of having these Confucius Institutes is that it gives the Chinese government financial leverage over colleges and universities. So the university administration itself has the incentive to abide by China's own censorious policies in order to keep the funding coming. Now, the Chinese government does have other means of providing funds to colleges and universities, and so colleges are still susceptible to that kind of leverage. And some universities that are closing their Confucius Institutes are trying to set up alternative partnerships in China. So that remains a concern and remains something that we need to watch closely.
Yeah. And I guess the question is, you've been getting some important help from Capitol Hill, as I recall, in this connection as well. Is this translating into legislation, much as you've been working on in the freedom of speech area, that might further catalyze the roll-up of this, well, Chinese communist propaganda and influence operation?
Well, one bill has been passed already, and that banned Pentagon funding for Confucius Institutes, and that has had a big effect in universities deciding to close their Confucius Institutes. The next big push is actually coming from Senator Rob Portman, who's looking at new transparency laws to update our existing transparency laws and close some loopholes so that, at the very least, we have more public information about what foreign governments like China are doing on college campuses. And that will be a big help in exposing what's going on and then holding to account the bad actors.
Well, we wish you every success in this regard and commend you for that you've already achieved. Rochelle Peterson, the policy director for the National Association of Scholars. Rochelle, come back to us again soon with updates, if you would, please.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Attention on deck. We have a Lieutenant Colonel, United States Marine Corps, now retired, alas, in the house virtually. He is Dakota Wood, known by his current title as a Senior Research Fellow for Defense Programs at the Heritage Foundation, but his reputation has been established both in uniform and in a variety of capacities, including as a Senior Fellow at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments in the past, but most especially when he was doing strategic planning for outfits like the Marine Corps Special Operations Command. He is a great resource and, among other things, the editor of an indispensable guide to the status of the U.S. military published by the Heritage Foundation. So we're delighted to ever, always, and anytime have a chance to pick his brain. Welcome back, Dakota. Glad to have you with us.
Always a great pleasure to be with you. Thanks.
Good. Well, we're going to have Captain Jim Fennell on shortly, and he spends a lot of time studying what's happening in the Pacific. But I thought I might just start with you, Dakota, on the sort of status of forces, if you will, or correlation of forces, more to the point, between what the United States Navy is able to deploy at any moment in the Pacific, particularly in the Western Pacific or the Indo-Pacific, as it's now being called, relative to what the Chinese are putting to sea or operating in those waters. Give us a sort of quick snapshot of what it looks like.
Yeah, this is a favorite issue brought up by critics of defense spending, and that the U.S. spends X amount more than the next six or eight countries combined. But what they don't account for is this correlation of forces that you rightly bring up. So if we look at the current U.S. Navy, about 290 ships, about 90 to 100 of those are available on any given day to be deployed. So we've got, let's say, 100 out in the world, but that's the entire world. And the Navy typically orients about 60 of those to the Indo-Pacific region. So out of a Navy shy of 300, you only have about 60 ships to cover the vast expanses of the Pacific and all of our interests with friends in that area. In comparison, China, its Navy is right around 300. I think it's going to go to about 350 here in the next 5 years. And all of their naval assets are right there in their home waters. So when you do those numbers, you're talking about 60 U.S. ships, if you aggregated them all, against 300 to 350 of China's. And then because you're close to China and 8,000 or 10,000 miles from the United States, China can support its operations with land-based aircraft, land-based anti-ship cruise missiles.
Ballistic missiles.
Absolutely. Ship-killing ballistic missiles. So we're really on the wrong side of that numbers curve.
Yeah. And Dakota, one of the things that we've, you know, historically taken comfort in is that we have a qualitative edge, even where we may face quantitative disadvantages. How true is that today vis-a-vis what the Chinese are putting up against us?
Yeah, you know, in the Cold War, the quality argument was the United States essentially against the Soviet Union. They had weapon systems that just bristled off their ships, but qualitatively, we were better. After the Cold War, there's really no other players for about 10 or 15 years. But China has really come up to speed. A lot of it has been industrial espionage, you know, stealing our stuff, but also developing it in-house. Tremendous computer capabilities, material sciences. They're in the process of building their third aircraft carrier. They have state-of-the-art submarines. So we just cannot accept that somehow we have this qualitative advantage that allows our 60, you know, to really contest the oceans against 300. So you can't step away from it, but it's not a panacea and it doesn't suffice to replace a lack of capacity.
Right. I think it was Stalin who said quantity has a quality all its own. So there's that. But now increasingly, in addition to the platforms, the hulls, if you will, we're seeing a lot of missiles and long range air and the like that is also in the mix. Qualitatively.
Yeah, a tremendous qualitative advantage. At some point, one of your ships is going to get hit. So if you have a few number of them, each one represents a greater percentage of available combat power. So if you have more numbers, you can take losses and continue to fight.
Yeah, and if you find yourself suffering a decisive preemptive strike against you, you could find yourself very much in a, shall we say, disadvantaged situation. Dakota, this is prompting, as I understand it, the United States military now to sort of revise the kind of thinking or strategic planning that it has been doing for most of the period, certainly since 9/11, but arguably before that, even in the absence of peer competitors and the like. Tell us a little bit about the return to great power competition, as I think it's being called, and how that figures into the kind of forces that we think we need and the budgets that we're going to have to acquire and maintain them.
Right. So again, going back to the Cold War, which is a great historical reference, percentage of GDP spent on defense accounted for this long contest with the Soviet Union. When that dissolved and Russia was on its back feet economically, they had nothing. China was not yet a global economic power with the ability to put money against military capabilities. And you didn't have the diffusion of advanced technologies, even in the hands of non-state actors like terrorist groups, you know, the web and enabling the transfer of technologies and all that. So over the last quarter century, the world has just changed. And since 9/11, which is a generation or two of military personnel, it's all been counterinsurgency, counterterrorism, and stability sorts of operations. So this was acknowledged by former Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis when he published the National Defense Strategy January or February a year ago. And it talked about the rise or the return of big powers like Russia and China in particular. And it pointed out how small our military has shrunk since Cold War days, you know, nearly 600 ships in the Navy, and now we're down to about 285. 750,000 U.S. soldiers and the active components of the Army, and now we're down to about 480,000. So it's a military that's half the size that it needs to be if you're still going to be a global player. And so the military has to go from a mindset where you're fighting terrorist groups, right, and insurgent groups, to how do you actually marshal combat capabilities to take on somebody like a China or a Russia. So this return to great power competition is driving all of their programming, all of their concepts, all of their training, and we're finding out that we've got huge gaps in capability.
Mm-hmm. In that regard, let me ask you, we have for quite some time now seen something called the Budget Control Act, very dramatically restricting the kind of investment that has been made, even in the counterinsurgency sort of oriented military of the past decade, let alone enabling us to take the steps we need to protect ourselves in the present great power competition, and that's now over the horizon. So Dakota Wood, tell us what's going on Capitol Hill with respect to this so-called sequestration vehicle that the Budget Control Act, or BCA, imposed upon the military for quite some time and with very deleterious effects.
Right. Well, it was passed in 2011, and it was supposed to stretch out 10 years. So it will go away. This current law will go in 2021. But it was supposed to be cuts to the military that were so painful that nobody would allow them to happen, and it would force this reconciliation between Democrats and Republicans to scale back government spending and reduce the debt. Well, clearly that didn't happen. So the military, the administration, both under the Obama presidency and now under the Trump presidency, and both parties in Congress realize you cannot fund a U.S. military with global responsibilities at funding levels provided by the Budget Control Act or sequestration, where anything above that is cut off. So they found these two-year budget agreements where they increase defense spending temporarily for a year or two, and then you have to revisit that. So in FY19, the current fiscal year, it's the second of the last two-year agreement. And so both parties are going to have to figure out how to increase spending through what's called OCO, or Overseas Contingency Operations Accounts that aren't subject to the limits. How do you increase funding for the next 2 years so that we don't see these dramatic cuts in readiness, the inability to start new programs, and our ability to compensate our men and women in uniform being deployed around the world? So, if it were to go back, it would be disastrous. We've talked with colleagues on Capitol Hill, and the political tensions between the two parties, the need to revisit raising the national debt ceiling, which is coming up, and the next year we'll be in the heat of a presidential campaign cycle. Prospects right now are fairly gloomy. They think perhaps continuing resolutions at current spending levels, which doesn't account for inflation and increased operational demands brought on by this return to great power competition. So we've got to get to 2021 and then see what the nation is willing to spend to secure its security and freedom and relationships with other countries.
But in the meantime, we need to get this workaround reestablished so that there's a continued improvement in the capabilities that we need. Dakota Wood, we appreciate your time with us today. Come back to us again, if you would, Dakota, very soon.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's my delight to say, joined by a man I've come to admire greatly, both for his service to our country over many years in the United States Navy, some 30 of them to be precise, and for the service that he is continuing to render now at the Geneva Center for Security Policy, not to be confused with the one here in the United States, which of course is sponsoring this program. He is a fellow there. His name is Captain James Fennell, United States Navy retired. He, among other things, held a number of senior intelligence positions in the Navy, among them serving as the chief of intelligence for the Pacific Fleet. And he has been active in raising the alarm about a subject that we talked about a moment ago with Dakota Wood, specifically the rise of China and the dangers that it poses to us and to freedom and freedom-loving people more generally. Captain Fennell, it is wonderful to have you back. Thank you so much for joining us. I know you're back on this side of the pond, which we're very pleased to have you here back in America. Welcome.
It's good to be back home, Frank. Thanks.
So, Jim, let me ask you, we talked with Dakota a bit about the kind of unbalanced situation that we find ourselves facing, the correlation of forces, pretty adverse and increasingly so, as both the numbers and quality of the Chinese Navy grows. But it raises a question that I think you've been mulling about for some time, too, which is the sort of capabilities and quality of our own Navy, not just that it's too small, but what it actually affords us in terms of power projection and, security in a very dynamic and increasingly dangerous competition with China. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, Frank, my thesis is that essentially since, Desert Storm up until the last couple of years, the United States Navy, went from being a major element of U.S. national security vis-a-vis the Soviet Union and their fleets that were around the world and that competition in the maritime domain to a land-centric orientation fighting, terrorism in the Middle Eastern countries, land-based warfare. And at one point, one of our leaders in the military and the Navy service, proudly proclaimed that we had more sailors ashore than afloat. So for 25 years, we kind of ignored or forgot about this possibility that we could ever have to fight a peer competitor at sea in the blue ocean. And that kind of lack of emphasis is really borne out in the fact that our surface ships don't have anti-ship cruise missiles to the same capability numbers that the Chinese today have. We're starting to turn on that, but we're way behind the Chinese, and they're outsticking us and outgunning us, and we need to get back to this, you know, what it means to be a blue water navy and to be able to fight and defeat other navies at sea.
Well, talk us through that, Jim, if you would, please, because you've walked the walk as well as thought about the talk.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the idea that we weren't going to face another competitor has borne out in the generations of officers that are serving today and the people in our acquisition community that are serving today that haven't had that pressure directed from the top down from the National Command Authority to tell them to go out and design and build a future fleet to do that kind of work. And so it's complex, and there's many facets to it. And today we live in a digital age where a lot of the weapon systems that we're going to use and the Chinese are going to use are dependent upon space-based assets and targeting information and cyber defense and cyber attack and these kinds of things. So it's much more complex today. And, you know, the U.S. Navy is aware of this, and they're moving in the right direction with things like distributed lethality and distributed maritime operations. But there's still a fundamental core issue there, which is, are we building our ships today to be able to fight and win wars against a Chinese Navy that's very, very capable? And I don't think we're quite there yet. In fact, I know we're not there yet. And that needs to be done and needs to be recognized as the prime directive for the U.S. Navy.
Well, let me ask you, I know you've been conferring with other people in the military and the community that supports it intellectually and in academia and so on. Do we even have, at the moment, the proper understanding, Jim Fennell, of the need to regard the Chinese as a formidable naval threat to us and one with which we may well find ourselves engaged in combat operations?
Well, this is an area that's very near and dear to me as a, you know, retired intelligence officer, which is to are we aware of the threat, and do we respect the threat? And if we did, then we'd be acting and behaving in a little bit more sense of urgency. And I don't see that. And so I'm up here in Newport. I've been back in D.C. I saw you in February. I met with folks in the Pentagon. And one of the things that I've told the naval leaders that I speak to, which is, we need to get serious about understanding and really believing that China's a competitor. And that doesn't mean that we have to aspire to war, but we have to understand that they're competing against us. They're at war with us, as we've discussed before. And assuming that we can just kind of, negotiate on this or continue past experiences of engagements and these kinds of things are not going to change the trajectory that China's on and the trajectory that we're on. And so I like to say to the Navy leaders, we need more true believers. And my experience here in the last couple of days up in Newport leads me to reconfirm that understanding that we still don't have enough true believers in what the Chinese threat is to our nation and to our Navy.
Yeah. True believers is sort of a loaded term. I think it seems to me what we're missing are people who are just realists, who are willing to look at the facts. And few people, Jim Fennell, have done a better job of documenting those facts, the emergence of the Chinese Navy as a formidable power, not just in their own home waters, but with considerable ability to project it well beyond, and the shipyards that support them that are seemingly cranking out vessels at a pace that I think, well, the closest I can recall is, sort of the amazing industrial output of the Liberty ships during World War II. It's almost at that kind of pace. So what we're talking about, Jim, is a question of, I guess, low expectations in terms of the Chinese that seem to be coloring our perceptions of what they're capable of as well as what they're doing. And this raises a question. It's a sensitive one, and I want to deal with it both sensitively and thoughtfully. We've had a kind of racism, one might say, in this approach to the Chinese, not giving them their due, not understanding how formidable they can be. putting us at grave risk, again, as you've documented. There's a controversy that's been going on, however, here for some time over some remarks that a woman by the name of Kyron Skinner, Dr. Skinner is now the director of the policy planning staff at the State Department. I spoke with Fred Flights about her yesterday in our program. Very formidable woman, a well-regarded, highly accomplished academic now in government. And she made a comment to the effect that we're simply not perhaps dealing competently with a non-Caucasian adversary. And that's caused all kinds of charges of racism on her part. She's, by the way, an African-American woman, and I think had no intention of making a racist comment. But Jim, one of the things that I know Bradley Thayer, another member, as are you, of our Committee on the Present Danger China has written about is the racism of the Chinese themselves, what he calls Han centrism. And I'd be interested in sort of your thoughts on all of these questions and whether we're really not dealing realistically with the adversary that is now increasingly, I think, at our throats.
I think there's truth to both sides of this coin, if you will. Clearly, what we're seeing the PRC do out in Xinjiang in the West is a very clear evidence of Chinese racism, Han racism against the Muslim section of their country, and then the way they're treating the Uyghurs. So it's very clear. That's undebatable. I look at it more from my perspective of U.S. assessments and intelligence community and academic assessments on Chinese capabilities, and I've run into it over and over over the years, which is to say, we downplay the Chinese capabilities because there's kind of an inherent racism on our side, which is to say, oh, they're Chinese, they can't do that, and I think that's very, very dangerous. I think it's stupid, and we need to respect the Chinese and consider that they're very, very capable in what they're trying to pursue, and not look down on that capability just because they're from China.
Well, and Jim Fennell, you have both studied this professionally for a long time. You've written extensively about it in your current capacity at the Geneva Center for Security Policy. I just want to say, ignore the fact that whatever their inherent capabilities may have been, we have been training now generations of Chinese students in the best universities this country has to offer in relevant technologies to the defense mission and more generally towards their growth as a world power. And I really feel as though we're at grave risk of, as you say, dangerously underestimating what they're capable of now, in addition to what they've stolen from us in terms of technology, what they're capable of inventing, developing, and bringing to bear against us as well. For all these reasons, Jim Fennell, your work is vitally needed and deeply appreciated, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. God bless you, my friend.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for the highlight of our week. Diana West is in the house, virtually, that is. She is, of course, a, well, extraordinary resource to this program and I think to the free world more generally for her writings, among other things, what you will find these days at dianawest.net. Her three terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up, American Betrayal, and her most recent, which is The Red Thread. All of these are available at Amazon, and I commend them to you. The Red Thread is also available at the Center for Security Policy site, securefreedom.org. And Diana is available to us each week. Thanks be to God. Diana, welcome. It's good to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank.
I wanted to talk to you first and foremost, Diana, about a book you put me onto, which I'm very excited to say is coming out in English in the United States of America, I believe next week. Its author is Vladimir Bukovsky, one of the most extraordinarily courageous and tenacious opponents of the old Soviet Union, a refusenik, I guess they called him. Talk a little bit about judgment in Moscow, Diana, and then I want to tease out some specific insights of it as well.
Yeah, I would love to. I'm presently working on a review of this amazing book. It's quite an event to have it coming out in English. Vladimir Bukovsky was, as you know, one of the leaders of the dissident movement in the Soviet Union. And what this meant was that this band of very courageous people took on the Soviet totalitarian monstrosity with nothing more than their own courage and the law as written in their fraudulent documents. No one was ever supposed to use the Soviet Constitution as a defense of anything. And yet these dissidents found this tremendous weak point in the entire morass in terms of holding them to their documents. And this became the basis of a number of court cases that they went into freely, knowing that they would end up in the gulag or psychiatric hospitals or labor camps, which is indeed how Vladimir Bukovsky spent most of his young adulthood, 12 years before being exchanged when he was in 1976. Most of his life had been spent this way. And their inspiration really comes through in this book, certainly, the story of this monument to free will and free speech and freedom.
Free speech is the point that I particularly wanted to address with you. There are a couple of news pegs for discussing this today, Diana, and I wanted to get your thoughts about them. The first is a woman by the name of Asia Bibi, Pakistani Christian woman who was on death row in Pakistan for 8 years for, well, exercising, I guess one might call, free speech in the face of Sharia blasphemy restrictions. Talk about that case, if you would, and more generally, what's being done to try to enforce these restrictions, not just in places like Pakistan, which is a Muslim country after all, but elsewhere in the world.
Well, this is a very similar totalitarian system. The system that has evolved under Islam over the centuries is exactly designed to punish those with free will, with other religious beliefs outside of Islam. And certainly in this case, we see a hero of this same cause of human freedom and the right to worship God as one chooses, not as Islamic law or the communist system dictate. And so this is one of these rare instances where we see someone come to public attention over the years, pay this terrible price of her own freedom and her own suffering, and yet at least we see her moving into a free world now, which is a great victory. But again, it's one human being, and I think one of the lessons of this period of this system of Vladimir Bukovsky's judgment in Moscow is how many people suffer under these totalitarian systems. And although his book is obviously about the communist system, we've been looking at the Islamic system and seeing the commonalities in terms of trying to control everyone, how they think, how they vote, how they believe, how they conduct themselves. I mean, this is the nature of totalitarianism, which is why we see so many similarities with Islamic law and communist law. It's the dictatorship of the human being, of the human soul.
I think of this Sharia supremacism really as communism with a god. It's very much the same sort of totalitarian thing, but with that patina of religiosity. Which brings me to the enemy within. I hear Diana West. There is a new report from a group that was founded by Hamas, which is, of course, for many years now been a designated terrorist organization. It's known as the Council on American Islamic Relations. And it just released this week a new attack on, among others, the Center for Security Policy. In fact, it claims that we are at the absolute center of this huge Islamophobic conspiracy. And I want to just say for the record, this is rubbish, of course, but it does speak once again to this sort of agenda. In this case, they're trying to go after people they think have given money to those of us who aren't conspirators. We're simply pointing out what Sharia involves and what groups like them tied to the Muslim Brotherhood are doing to try to impose it on the rest of us. But Diana, talk a little bit more about this effort that the left is now joined with organizations, Brotherhood front groups like CARE, to foist on us, which really are, well, effectively Sharia blasphemy restrictions here in the United States as well. You've written about some of this in connection with one of your recent blog postings on this banning by social media platforms. Connect those dots for us, if you would.
Well, again, we see this commonality between dictatorial systems like Islam, like communism, to control and to control even the opposition within. I mean, this is a big tool of manipulation. And using the word conspiracy in this report, it issued by CARE, unindicted co-conspirators in the landmark terrorism financing trial, the Holy Land Foundation trial. I mean, it's a travesty that they are even given the time of day, given that one very landmark case and their role in this terrorism financing network. But that be that as it may, the use of the word conspiracy is something, again, another common trick that is really designed to manipulate people reading it. It's not designed to explain anything or bring any sort of factual understanding of what Center for Security Policy or anyone else in the world is doing. It's supposed to be a buzzword that makes people say, ew, and toxic and bad. This is sort of the programmed response, the Pavlovian response, if you will, that we in the West have become conditioned to trigger. And this in and of itself shows the bankruptcy of the whole report. Because when, as you say, the Center for Security Policy and its associates and others who are not associated simply try to explain Islam, try to explain Sharia law, try to unravel what is going on with our world in terms of this Islamization through migration and various Sharia compliance and finance and education and all the rest of it. This is not a conspiracy. This is just an elucidation. But they have to turn it and try to deflect and try to manipulate the response.
Suppress. Is the operative word.
And bar any natural kind of reaction to it and understanding by trying to shroud it in words like conspiracy. So it's really just more propaganda.
Yeah, it is propaganda. And I would just say two things, if I may, Diana. One is, of course, a main ally of groups like CARE and all of this has been the Southern Poverty Law Center. And talk about deflection. This is a group that has been accusing everybody else of hating and bigotry and racism and so on. They now stand accused of it themselves by people who've worked for the organization for, in some cases, quite some time. And then secondly, this whole idea that we're a bunch of conspiracy theorists, it's not true, of course, but in addition, if it were true, we'd certainly have a lot of company in this town at the moment, not just from the CARE and its grand conspiracy theorizing, but of course, all of the people that you've studied closely in the red thread, Diana, that have been spinning this conspiracy of Donald Trump and collusive activities with the Russians and the like. So anyway, Diana, thank you for joining us today for this important visit, and come back to us again next week.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.